and welcome to the Road to Genome podcast. This episode is being brought to you from Genomics England's headquarters in central London. I'm your host, Helen Bethel, genetic counsellor and podcast host for Northeastern Yorkshire Genomic Medicine Service. I'm delighted to be joined by David Bick, Principal Clinician of the Newborn Genomes Programme at Genomics England. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you for having me.
Can we start with then, what is your current job title and what does it mean?
So my role at Genomics England is as the principal clinician for the Newborn Genomes Program. And this is a very exciting program that started 3 years ago to sequence 100,000 newborns and look for treatable conditions. And then when we find them, to have those children be seen by a specialist and treated right away before they get sick.
Wow. It's an absolutely huge role. Was this something that you dreamed of being as a child or a teenager?
So how did I get to genetics is kind of the question. So I remember when I was in high school, I had two cousins, Robbie and Jimmy, who were both physicians. And I remember I would see them at Thanksgiving, kind of a U.S. thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to visit my cousin Robbie in medical school. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, now this is really interesting, being a doctor.
Yeah.
And then when I got to college, I remember my freshman biology course. Mm-hmm. We all take freshman biology. And during that course, they had a segment on genetics. And I thought to myself, well, this makes perfect sense. This is a part of biology I can understand. Mm-hmm. And so that made me very excited. And then I think I was a sophomore. I was involved in a course. I can't remember quite a lot about the course, but I remember I became so excited. I bought a textbook of genetics right. called The Metabolic Basis of Inherited Diseases.
Wow.
And I started reading that, and I was hooked.
Yeah. Okay. And so are you a geneticist, a clinical geneticist? By trade, would that be your kind of route into then Genomics England?
I think that would be a fair statement. So after medical school, mm-hmm. I then did a residency in pediatrics, which is a 3-year stint. And then I followed that with 3 years of training in genetics, both mm-hmm. clinical genetics and in molecular. Mm-hmm. And so then for 35 years, I practiced clinical genetics.
Yeah.
And I ran whole genome sequencing clinical laboratories for more than 10 years. During that time, I became involved with Genomics England. Mm-hmm. It was, I think, in 2012 or 2013. Genomics England was invented. And at that time, who was the prime minister? It was David Cameron. Yes. Mm-hmm. At the time, David Cameron had an idea that he wanted to have a project mm-hmm. In the NHS. And mm-hmm. he spoke to one of his advisors, who was John Bell, who was mm-hmm. then the Regius Professor at Oxford. And John Bell came up with this idea of doing sequencing 100,000 individuals mm-hmm. For cancer and rare disease. Mm-hmm. And by chance, I had given a talk at Oxford, I guess maybe 6 months before this mm-hmm. all happened. And he remembered this talk I gave because when I was in the United States, and this is a bit of the history, we were the first group, my group in Wisconsin, we were the first group to use whole genome sequencing as a clinical test.
Oh, yeah.
And this had been based on a child that we had diagnosed with a rare condition that required a bone marrow transplant. So this child, whose name I can say on the air because there's a book written about him, his name was Nick Volker. He was the first child who had genomic medicine actually was used to change his treatment. He got a bone marrow transplant, mm-hmm. which cured him.
Wow.
And so because of that, the hospital I was working mm-hmm. with elected to start a genomics program. And so we were the first genomic medicine program in the United States.
Incredible.
And so when I was over here in England, my wife was on a book tour at the time, and I went to Oxford and gave this lecture about our program because this was in the very, very early days of genomics.
Yeah.
And I met John Bell at that time, And I didn't think anything more of it. And then like 6 months later, I get a phone call from John. He's saying, well, we're going to start this program to sequence 100,000 mm-hmm. children with rare disease and also, or actually about 50,000 with rare disease and 50,000 with cancer. Mm-hmm. And he said, David, I'd like you to be on our scientific advisory board.
Wow.
And so I ended up on the scientific advisory board for Genomics England right from the beginning. That's how I got to know Richard Scott and a bunch of other people around here. And then it was around 2019, Sally Davies, who was then the chief medical officer for England, had an idea, could we use whole genome sequencing as an adjunct to the current newborn screening program? And so at that time, through Mark Caulfield, who was also at that time at Genomics England, I was invited to be on a panel with Mark and a bunch of other people, Richard Scott, and they produced a document that probably, you know, the committee thought it was a good idea to have a research program mm-hmm. to investigate the question, could we use whole genome sequencing as an adjunct to newborn screening? And so again, I was on that committee and I thought that was very interesting. And then Richard Scott, myself, and another geneticist named David Dimmick, we started to put together a list of, well, treatable genetic conditions. Mm-hmm. And so I thought to myself, oh, maybe there'll be 50 or 100. Mm-hmm. And the more I looked, the more I found.
Yeah.
And so in fact, during COVID lockdown mm-hmm. in the United States, I started up a website with Richard Scott called rxgenes.com. And it now has more than 800 treatable genetic conditions.
Wow.
So after that went on for a while, at Genomics England, they had a public engagement, a very important public engagement in 2021, I believe mm-hmm. it was, where they asked the public, what would you think about using whole genome sequencing mm-hmm. as an adjunct to newborn screening? Mm-hmm. And the public came back with two very important points. Their first was, we're interested in you looking in babies for genetic conditions, but mm-hmm. only if they're treatable. Mm-hmm. And we want those treatments to be ones where you really need to initiate them in the first few years of mm-hmm. life. Mm-hmm. They weren't interested at that time mm-hmm. In, for example, BRCA1, a gene connected adult onset conditions. They really wanted to focus on mm-hmm. treatable conditions mm-hmm. For children. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what the program was set up. And then when the government funded the program in 2021, then Richard Scott called me up and said, look, David, we're starting this program. Would you be interested in, you know, helping us out here at Genomics England? So I joined Genomics England and fantastic. I guess the rest is history.
Yeah. So can you tell us where you're up to then with the generation study?
Yes, the generation study is going extremely well. I will say that we've spent 3 years really in the planning, and I just want to emphasize how important that planning mm-hmm. was. Mm-hmm. We had a large consultation, not only with the public, but also with physicians mm-hmm. across the NHS and NHS England, mm-hmm. who are really our partners in all of this, were incredibly important, incredibly mm-hmm. supportive. Also, the Newborn Screening Committee in England, they were also very helpful and very supportive. Mm-hmm. But we took a lot of care mm-hmm. to make sure that this was designed and set up with all of the important stakeholders mm-hmm. deeply involved. Mm-hmm. For example, we spent a lot of time with moms and dads who mm-hmm. were either pregnant or couples who had recently had a child mm-hmm. to think about the actual materials mm-hmm. that we would discuss with them. Mm-hmm. And so this was, I think, one of the reasons that we're successful now mm-hmm. is because we had engaged with all of the mm-hmm. other important groups in England. Yep. We started collecting samples, I want to say, in April of last mm-hmm. year, and we're now up to about 6,000 families have enrolled, and we've sequenced about 3,000 mm-hmm. Children to date. Mm-hmm. So for these 3,000 children, we are finding diagnoses. Mm-hmm. And I will just say that our list of conditions is about 200, and there are 462 genes on our list of genes that we're looking for. And it's important to remember, some conditions are caused by more than one gene. So this has been going very well. We have 27 trusts that where we are enrolling patients at the present time. We're working very hard to increase that number, and we want to reach our goal of 100,000 as quickly as we can. We anticipate another couple of years to get all of the numbers that we need. What's amazing, again, is that we are finding children with treatable conditions, and we're finding them at a time when the parents and their doctors were not aware that the children had those conditions. So that's very exciting.
Yeah. So have you had a case where there's been a child affected that has managed to engage in treatment?
Yes, there have been a number of cases where we have actually found the child, the treatment, and treatments have been undertaken. Now, one of the pieces of the puzzle is we're so new in the program that we don't have yet a great deal of follow-up information from those clinicians. And so because the cases that we found are so recent, we're still just now sending out in questionnaires to those clinicians, asking them, okay, what did you find when you saw these children, and what were the follow-up testing, and what was the follow-up outcome so far for their treatments? One of the things that's really important to know about the program is we really chose conditions where, in virtually all instances, there is a non-DNA test which can confirm the diagnosis. The other thing we've done is we've really focused on DNA changes, variants, if you will, which are pathogenic or likely pathogenic. We did not want to get involved in variants of uncertain significance because we wanted our program to have very high specificity. In other words, if we call a parent, we're quite worried. Now, we do recognize, like any kind of screening program, when you focus on specificity, you are going to lose sensitivity compared to, say, the current newborn screening, which is biochemical screening. But all of that being said, this is an approach to newborn screening, which is really novel and will allow us the potential to add hundreds of conditions at once and find children who have no opportunity to be found at this point. There is a lot of effort around the world now in the same direction, going in the same direction we are. There are, I can think of more than 30 programs around the world similar to ours. Many are smaller, but their approach, their general approach is the same. Let's choose conditions. Let's look for them when children, you know, soon after birth, and let's get those children to be seen by specialists as quickly as possible. There's actually an organization called the International Consortium on Newborn Sequencing, ICONS, which has been started. And so literally every month, 70 or 80 individuals from around the world, from all of these programs, we get together on a call to sort of compare notes. And there'll also be a, actually, this is sort of a timely that we're talking about this because there's going to be a meeting in London of this group in October. So there's a huge amount of interest around the world to advance newborn screening using genomics. And one of the ways that I always like to think about this is we're using what we would consider a relatively new technology. But if you work your way back into the 80s and 90s, there was a technology called tandem mass spectroscopy, which was just coming into use. And it was at that time that newborn screening programs around the world moved from, if you will, one at a time sort of testing, testing for thyroid, testing for PKU, as individual one-off sort of tests, and combining them and allowing a technology, in this case, tandem mass spectroscopy, to massively increase, compared to where we were, massively increase the number of conditions we could look for. And so in many ways, what we're doing with whole genome screening is really just another
echo of that. Yes.
Exactly. An echo of what has come before. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Naima Kalachand, and I'm the host of Behind the Genes, Genomics England's podcast. Join us for the latest in cutting-edge research and real-life stories from people affected by rare conditions and cancer. Through thoughtful conversations, we'll take you behind the science. Plus, check out our Genomics 101 explainer episodes, where we break down complex genetic terms in under 10 minutes. Subscribe to Behind the Genes on your favourite podcast app today.
So you mentioned that you're still at the process of kind of collating feedback from clinicians of the experience of dealing with these cases. What about the parents' experience of going through this? What are the plans for collecting that?
Yes, we have, and I probably should have said this earlier on, we have three main goals for the program. The first is sort of the most obvious goal, which is, what is the clinical utility mm-hmm. of whole genome sequencing? In other words, when I say clinical utility, what I'm saying is, will this test mm-hmm. improve the outcome mm-hmm. of the children identified? Mm-hmm. So that's the most basic question. And that's the question that the clinicians mm-hmm. are really focused on. Mm-hmm. They want to know, if I agree to do this test, if mm-hmm. I'm going to help promote this long term, mm-hmm. will this improve the outcome of my mm-hmm. of my patients? Mm-hmm. So that's the most basic mm-hmm. Outcome measure. There are two other very significant outcome measures. And one is the perception of the parents. Mm-hmm. Did they think this was a good idea? And so we have a major program underway already mm-hmm. to talk to parents who've had either a screen negative result or a screen positive result. Mm-hmm. We're already starting to ask these individuals, what was their experience mm-hmm. with the program? Because obviously, if the parents don't see this as valuable, we should not be doing this. Mm-hmm. And third, and I would say also very important, is, are we going to save money? Mm-hmm. Does this make economic sense? Mm-hmm. So all three of those groups, the parents, who mm-hmm. I consider the most important group, mm-hmm. the clinicians, are they seeing this as helping them help their patients? And obviously, since the NHS is a national health system, is this going to save money for the national health system? Mm-hmm. I think this notion that we could find children before they get sick mm-hmm. is one which I think resonates with parents. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that's something that the NHS is really interested in.
Yeah, I agree. So thinking back to your clinical practice, is there a case that kind of has stayed with you, that drives you in the work that you do?
So as mentioned before, I practiced clinical genetics for 35 mm-hmm. years, and I did see numerous cases along the way, thinking, if we had known sooner, mm-hmm. we could have done more for this child. Mm-hmm. And so that general feeling has always stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And in a way, the program that I'm involved in now mm-hmm. will allow me to help even more children mm-hmm. than I ever could in the past. And so even though I may never meet any of these children, this notion that we could find children before they get sick mm-hmm. is very exciting. This is the most interesting program I've been involved in my entire medical career.
Yeah, it's great to hear your passion, David, and, you know, kind of hearing that full circle, as you say, of kind of being in a position where it's a late diagnosis and there's little that can be offered, through to a program where you're really championing that testing before symptoms even begin. And, you know, in those scenarios you describe, as you say, I think most people would agree that it's incredibly worthwhile, the work that's been done. In terms of your job then, what does a good day look like for you in coming to work?
Well, I will say that now that we're actually analyzing mm-hmm. genomes, One of the things I do is I take a look at the genomes that were have been positive. So our pipeline works as follows. Moms and dads sign up for the program in the middle of the pregnancy. And then when the child is born, we take cord blood. There are a number of situations where you can't get cord blood, so we'll do a heel stick. So this is on day zero of life. Those samples then go to an extraction core, and those extraction cores then plate the DNA and send it on to a central sequencing facility. The results of that sequencing comes to Genomics England. And here we've set up a pipeline that will look for specific variants. We have a variety of sources for these pathogenic and likely pathogenic variants. And then in addition, when a gene is of the sort loss of function, we will include premature stop or frame shift or other canonical splice variants which we expect to be pathogenic. So we combine all of that information, and we're finding at this point about 5% of the time we're needing to look more carefully at what comes through the pipeline. There are some amazing clinical scientists from the NHS who are looking at the cases. And so I look at the cases, but they're really looking obviously more deeply at the cases. So on a good day, I get to see these cases that are coming through and talk to the clinical scientists about the cases. The other things that are fantastic is we're looking to the future. How can we make this better? What can we do to adjust the pipeline to find more children, but at the same time not have false positives or keep the false positive rate very low? So that's another important part. Can we add genes? As I mentioned, the program is really about variants in the sense that you, if you have a gene, how many cases you find depends on how many variants you included in your lists. So that's another area that I'm really focused on, is adding genes, but also adding more pathogenic variants. Where can we bring those in? So that's really, those are exciting areas. The other area which is really interesting is when we have a positive case, it's not unusual for us to be in touch with a specialist or specialists who know that disease well and consult with them about, look, we found these variants, we believe that this makes sense, and for them to sort of validate what we're doing. One of the things that's important in the program is we've already enlisted clinicians, specialists from every trust for every specialty. So we know who to call with a result when we get an abnormal result. But there are occasions where the clinical scientists have some questions about whether the variants should be reported at all. And so that's where the specialist community in England have been incredibly generous with their time in terms of us talking to them. And so even though we've not had a huge number of cases come through, again, being able to rapidly reach out to and get advice from these clinical specialists has been really tremendous. And it's one of the things that's sort of amazing for me is how deep and how wonderful the knowledge is of the clinical specialists in England. They're just amazing.
And I, when I'm hearing you talk, David, I was reflecting that, you know, as a clinician, you've almost kind of reversed your roles in now working more in that clinical scientist element of using the results and passing those over to the clinician. How does that compare for you?
So I sort of always wear my old clinical hat and my molecular genetics hat. And I try to focus on making sure that we really do have good communication between the clinical scientists and the clinicians on the ground who will be actually caring for those patients. And because I sort of know both sides, I've been that clinician and I've also been that laboratory director. So I've been on both sides of this. And so I feel that I know what each side really wants to achieve.
Yeah, so that's great. You sound so perfectly placed in that role. So on the reverse side, what does a challenging day at work look like for you?
So what's challenging, and maybe this has come through in the way I talk about things, is I want to go faster because I know that every child, every gene, every variant that we can add and every case that we can look at is a chance for us to save a child's life, mm-hmm. to make the child's life better, and to help those parents help their child to have a really good life. Mm-hmm. And so I want to go faster because we can save more lives. Mm-hmm. The other piece of it is, I also work with this organization, ICONS, mm-hmm. and they are also working with groups around the world. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always trying to get people to go faster, to work harder at this. Now, it is incredibly important that we realize these are infants. Mm-hmm. And these children are some mom and dad's mm-hmm. precious child. Mm-hmm. And as long as we keep that in mind, as long as we're driving to realizing this is somebody's child, I think that will make us do this safely, but also push us to try and do this as quickly as possible, because we can save those lives. We can help those parents. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So thinking about the future then, we've touched on it a few times already, but what do you see as the most exciting thing that is coming down the line in genomics?
So in genomics, I think treatment is where the world is heading. Mm-hmm. The advances in gene therapy have mm-hmm. just been remarkable. Mm-hmm. Also, there are plenty of therapies for children that don't involve gene mm-hmm. therapy, but which, if you introduce them very early on, mm-hmm. make a big difference. So mm-hmm. I think that the world of the future, the world of my daughter, I will just say my daughter is finishing her clinical genetics training.
Oh, wow, fantastic. So it is in the family.
It is in the family. She's finishing her training in metabolic genetics.
Okay.
And when she and I talk, we talk about the future being about treatment. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's where the future lies. Mm-hmm. So what can we do mm-hmm. to bring about that future faster? Mm-hmm. One of the things we can do, or one of the things that's happening, is that the cost of sequencing is mm-hmm. dropping rapidly. Mm-hmm. So in a country like England, which has resources, or a country like the United States, which has resources, they can pursue genomics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a less economically well-off country, mm-hmm. that really is a barrier. Mm-hmm. So that barrier is dropping. Mm-hmm. The other incredibly important piece that I see moving along beautifully is long read sequencing. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. at the present time, the sequencing we use is called short read sequencing. We get pieces of DNA sequence, which are about 150 base pairs long, mm-hmm. and you get hundreds of millions of these pieces. So it's just like a giant jigsaw puzzle with 100 million pieces. But with long read sequencing, your piece of DNA that you've sequenced can be 10,000 or 20,000 base pairs long. So instead of your puzzle having 100 million pieces, maybe it only has 10,000 pieces. And those pieces overlap beautifully. And so your ability to construct what the genome looks like is amazing. Mm-hmm. And the other piece is that we can phase the genome. Mm-hmm. We can tell if there are two DNA changes mm-hmm. in a recessive condition. Are they on a chromosome together so that the other chromosome is normal? Mm-hmm. Or are they on separate chromosomes?
Yeah.
And long read sequencing does a beautiful job mm-hmm. of sorting that out. Mm-hmm. So that to me is one of the great advances that mm-hmm. we're going to see. We can sequence faster, cheaper, and more accurately.
Really? Yeah.
And then the other piece, which I don't know, it sort of sounds trite, but the use of machine learning, some people call artificial intelligence, if you will, I think has the ability to mm-hmm. help the clinical scientists mm-hmm. get through cases faster. it's not going to be replacing the clinical scientists. Mm-hmm. But if you could provide the clinical scientists a look at the genome mm-hmm. and help them find the information for deciding whether a variant is pathogenic or not, mm-hmm. the AI can really do that. Mm-hmm. And we're actually starting to work on a project here mm-hmm. to actually start to look at the question, can we use machine learning, if you will, AI, to provide information more quickly, mm-hmm. more efficiently to the specialists so that they could make judgments.
Mm-hmm. So for you, David, where do you think your ambition will take you next?
It's hard to say. I'm really so enjoying working at Genomics England yeah. on a project that I see being able to help people, children all over the world and families. It's hard to imagine what the future might hold exactly for me.
Yeah.
I think that working in this field and trying to move this along for years to come will be very satisfying.
Yeah. Well, it's been absolutely fantastic to talk to you, David, and hear more about the generation study. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you would like more information about the topics that we have discussed today, then you can find these on ny-genomics.org.uk/podcast. You'll also find here all the episodes in our podcast series. All episodes can also be accessed via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all other major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.